This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Krupa Party and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Good to have you with us. We are a few days of New Year's Eve, and if you are celebrating, you might be getting your outfit in order, maybe having a browse in the shops or online. I wonder whether you'd consider trying out one of 2024's fashion trends, pants on the outside. You might, like me, think the Wonder Woman style isn't for you. Vogue's fashion editor Julia Hobbs is going to tell us how it went for her when she went out in a pair of golden bejeweled knickers. What is the most outrageous fashion trend that you have tried? Maybe you don't think it's outrageous at all. What have you deliberately worn to get attention? You can text the programme on any of the stories that we cover. That number is 84844 on Instagram and X, formerly known as Twitter. We are at BBC Women's Hour. You can email us through our website and you can send us a WhatsApp message or voice note using the number 03700 100 444. All of our terms and conditions can be found on our website. And a special request on this, do send us any photos you might have of your attention-seeking clothes if you can. Also on the programme, getting the grades, going to university and graduating is an achievement for many young people. And family support, may that be moral, emotional or financial, will be an important part of that educational journey. We're going to speak to two care-experienced young women who have achieved all of that and more against the odds without that support network. And this year has been yet another difficult one for our maternity services. Just last month, two-thirds of England's maternity units were called dangerously substandard by the Care Quality Commission. We're going to explore unassisted births, women having babies without a healthcare professional present, and whether the anecdotal rise in these is a response to the failings of our maternity systems. All of that's coming up. But we begin in India. And just a warning, in this item, we will be talking about violence and sexual assault. Earlier this month in the state of Karnataka in the southwest of India, a 42-year-old woman was stripped, tied to an electricity pole and beaten for hours. This was all because her son had eloped with his girlfriend who was supposed to marry someone else the following day. There was another case back in the summer, which we discussed here on the programme. It took place in Manipur in northeast India and made headlines around the world when two women were stripped naked by a mob of men, paraded and allegedly gang raped. A video of the pair went viral on social media. To find out more, I'm joined from Delhi by Geeta Pandey, the BBC's Women and Social Affairs Editor from BBC Online in Delhi. Good to have you with us, Geeta. Let's go to the beginning of all of this. Can you tell us what happened in Karnataka?
Well, in Karnataka, this 42-year-old woman was alone at home at night and she was sleeping when about a dozen men barged into her house. They dragged her out, they stripped her, they paraded her naked through the village, then tied her to an electricity pole, and she was assaulted for several hours until the police, who were informed about it, and they came and they rescued her. She is now recovering in hospital. The reason why all this happened was because her son had eloped with a girl, with his girlfriend, who also belonged to the same village. And clearly the girl's family did not approve of the relationship. And they decided to take it out on the mother. So this woman was punished for something that her son had done, which the girl's family considered a huge transgression.
Punished and clearly suffering in terms of the legal framework around this. First of all, where are we with that? What's happened with this case in the courts?
Well, the case has been taken up by the judges of the Karnataka High Court of their own accord, and they summoned the police, and it's become a fairly big case now. The judges were furious. They were also shocked. They said that they could not imagine that something like this could happen in modern India. And we have been told that more than a dozen people have been arrested by the police, and they are in police custody. And at least one police officer from the local police station has been suspended for dereliction of duty. And the police said that they have formed a committee which is investigating the case. So we would know more about the case, I guess, in due course of time. But of course, it's something that the spotlight is on, and more so because the court has taken a very strong stand on the issue.
Another line from the judges that stood out to me, Geetha, was them calling for collective responsibility. One of them talked of collected cowardice and that all of those who witness this should essentially be punished. I wonder how that's been received. That really stood out for me.
Well, yes, because, you know, if you think about it, I mean, there were about 50 to 60 people who watched this atrocity and no one intervened. According to the court, there was only one person who tried to intervene. He was beaten up. He was also assaulted. But the rest of the people just stood by and watched. And if you think about it, you know, they just did not watch, because clearly there were people who were taking pictures, who were making videos, which was later on shared until it, you know, it came out and it became viral, and police and the authorities took action. But, you know, think about it. What does it say about people? I mean, you know, like the kind of voyeurism that actually, you know, accompanied something, an incident that was so horrific, that was so horrible.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Geetha, just explain to us then, what is the current legislation around this practice?
Well, the Indian law, basically, there is one section of the Indian law which deals with cases like these, which is essentially, I mean, it's called assault with intent to outrage the modesty of a woman, right?
Yes.
And and you know, so it includes something of this kind, which is so heinous because it involved disrobing. So the people who were arrested have been charged under this act. But it's an act which also deals with cases of street harassment, or somebody passing a lewd remark, or someone groping or touching, or making lewd gestures. So some of those cases are not so serious. But something like this, disrobing a woman and parading her naked, humiliating her in public, is also something that's dealt with a law like that, which essentially means a prison term of 3 to 7 years, which lawyers and campaigners are saying is grossly inadequate and it's not enough.
For a bit more context, Geetha, a lot of the women we hear about in the media who have gone through this are from the Dalit community, that is a member of the lowest class of the traditional Hindu social hierarchy. But does this affect women from all backgrounds? We just don't hear about it as often?
Well, in this case, let me clarify that both the families belong to the same community and they lived in the same village. So there was no question of any caste or any other angle being involved here. This was essentially a conflict between families, between two different families. But I think you're right when you say that, you know, a lot of the women are from disadvantaged background, whether it comes to caste or whether it comes to financially disadvantaged background. So a lot of women come from, you know, families like that. You would rarely ever, if ever, hear a case involving a woman from a from an affluent family, from an affluent background, you know, or from someone of an upper caste. I mean, those cases are extremely rare if they happen at all.
Yeah. Stay with us, Geetha. I want to bring in Dr. Udithi Sen, a professor of modern Indian history at the University of Nottingham, specializing in gender and feminism. Good to have you with us, Dr. Sen. Do we have any data around this? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is how rare an event is this in India?
Thank you for having me. I think the first thing I would like to say is how we categorize events really impacts how we understand it, right? So one way of looking at it would be to go looking for, you know, instances where women have been, you know, stripped or paraded naked as somehow this special kind of category of instance. And I think in that case, we ourselves will also fall prey to the same voyeurism which we are trying to critique, right? Now, this is a form of violence against women which is used not just against the women who are violated in this way, but is used against the entire family. It's a statement of power, of control, of authority against the family, against this boy who's dared to love a girl who this family considers is to be above his status. So they are from the same community, no doubt, but the girl's family is better connected. The girl's family is economically superior. The boy's father is a truck driver, and he's an outsider in the village. So though it's from within the same community, there are clear incidents, like there's clear relevance of class here, where, you know, the boy has seen to be, you know, to be an upstart. So this is the, this act of attacking an entire family or an entire community through attacking a woman is what is happening here. And I think we will miss the point if we just focus on, you know, a particularly outrageous act of a woman being publicly humiliated or, you know, publicly stripped. Because what is at stake here is this notion, and this, you know, Indian feminists have been fighting against this for decades now, is this notion that the honor of a family or a community, you know, lies in the woman's body.
Just to go back on what you were saying about how focusing on one aspect isn't sufficient, but it is the public humiliation aspect of this that has brought this case and others to not just national but global attention.
It is true, but I think, you know, we do need to look at, you know, if we just stop at the public humiliation, we do not understand what's at stake, because what's at stake here is the autonomy of women. So the autonomy of a woman which has been denied is also the autonomy of this 18-year-old girl who's now an adult and has clearly eloped with this man. Now, the focus on, you know, this, because it's almost, you know, it's Game of Thrones-ish, you know, it's, you know, it's almost speaks of, you know, that kind of, you know, we have to acknowledge this, that there's a voyeur in all of us, right? Clickbait works, you know, nudity works, you know, sex works, it sells, right? So if we focus on that, what we are ignoring is somewhere in Karnataka is an 18-year-old girl who's terrified and is hiding and is wondering what will be her punishment for daring to elope with this 24-year-old boy. Now, there is no law against forced marriages in India, right? The law focuses on child marriage. There's no law against marital rape in India. Right? So a wife can be raped by, you know, her husband with impunity.
And all of that leads me to question the relationship that women, particularly vulnerable women, might have with the police, whether they'd feel comfortable going to the police if anything happened to them.
They don't, but I think we also have to look at this, you know, in the current context of law and order in Karnataka and in India. Because this particular, because you're right, that this is a public case of humiliation, a public case of violence. The truth of it is that there has been an alarming rise in, you know, public violence against weaker communities in recent years. This is not a hangover from some medieval period. This is a political, you know, modern situation we are looking at, where there are vigilante groups who are acting with impunity against the weaker sections of society, whether it be Dalits or whether it be Muslims. And this has been given a carte blanche by, you know, the rise of, you know, Hindu right sentiments or the Hindutva ideology, which places morality and social policing above law and order. Right. So you have politicians who've gone on record saying, oh, you know, if sentiments are offended, there'll be action and reaction. So if you dig deeper into this, what you'll find is that some of the men who participated in this are known assailants. These will be people who have a track record of violence and are roaming around with impunity. And they probably don't have a track record of violence against women, but against Dalits, against Muslims. So the idea of collective responsibility to be placed on the villages is therefore grievously wrong, because what are they going to do in a political culture where these kind of elements have been allowed to, you know, believe that they have the right to morally police society?
Dr. Sen, you've highlighted clearly the problems, and I've not left sufficient time for the answers and the solutions, because I'm sure they are extensive and complex. But we know that there are so many women's rights groups in India trying to work on these issues, find a solution. I mean, I imagine it's hard for them to operate. What are, or what is being worked on, both at grassroots level and national level?
So I would like to name two organizations here. There's the Mahila Durjanya Virodhi Akuta and the Jagruti Mahila Vakut. We don't hear of them because these are local grassroots organizations. They work with local villages. They work on education. They work with primary school children to change their views on gender. And they work with differently abled. They work with transgender women. They work on right to education, right to health. So what women's organizations have is a holistic view of the problem, right? That you cannot just treat this as a law and order problem. Yes, we need the laws to change, because the laws also reflect a certain kind of conservative patriarchal mindset, right? But at the same time, you also need to change the mindset of people. So people have been working on this for years. They have protested against this incident and they will continue to work. Unfortunately, what we also have is this incident being politicized. So now it's been politicized as, you know, a blame game between the two key political parties, which is the Indian National Congress and the BJP, where each of them are accusing the other of failing to protect women adequately. Now, this is the same patriarchal mindset of, you know, who did better by whose women. But again, you know, there's a loss of autonomy of, you know, women as, you know, equal citizens. And there's a blame game amongst men. And, you know, the West is also guilty of that, that we can try and feel better that, oh, here women are not treated as badly. Or look how horrible it is in India. But I think really, if we are going to look for solutions, we have to, you know, look at what Jagruti is doing. They have a website. Yeah. We have to look at what, you know, Mahila Durjanya Virodhi Akuta is doing. These are not one-time solutions. These are long solutions, and they are working at the ground level.
Yeah.
The problem really is this change in political climate, which makes moral policing and vigilante violence acceptable.
Dr. Aditi Sen, I'm going to stop you there, but fascinating insights from you. Thank you for introducing us to what is a really complex and multi-layered dilemma in India, and what is such a diverse nation as well. Thank you so much for your insights, and Geetha Pandey from the BBC for that update on that case that is getting significant attention in India. Thank you both for your time. Our next conversation is about changing fortunes when you've not had the best start in life. According to a report by the think tank Civitas this year, just 14% of care leavers go to university, compared to 47% of young people who didn't grow up in care. And those figures have barely changed over the past 10 years. And at the current rate of progress, it will take over 100 years to close that gap. But joining me now are two young, care experienced women who have bucked that trend. They care passionately about girls going through similar life experiences, and they want to share what they have learned. So let me introduce you to Lucy Barnes, a barrister, and Rebecca Munro, who graduated with a master's in business and is now the education liaison officer at the University of St Andrews. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Lucy, you're here with me in the studio. I want to start with clarifying the language around what we're talking about. When we say care leavers, care experience, what does that mean?
Personally, I prefer the term care experience because the term care leaver implies that care leaves you, and it really shouldn't, because in a normal traditional family environment, your family don't leave you. So, you know, when you're care experienced, it's a positive term. It connotates a community, which is actually really supportive on the whole community, which gives you a sense of, okay, others are here, they can do it too. But care leaver makes you feel somewhat isolated and that you're different in some way.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked that first because it almost changes the direction of the rest of our conversation. Yeah. Thank you for that. I want to hear both of your stories. Rebecca, I'll start with you. Both of you have excelled academically. You both entered the care system age 13. Take me back, Rebecca, to those days. What's care been like for you?
So care has been multifaceted, I would say. I think I didn't know about the care system before I entered it. And when I entered it, I was alone. I was split from my sibling. And it was just a really daunting experience to just kind of be, you know, at one point with the family, regardless of how dysfunctional it is, then being in a space with strangers, but people who are there and wanting to kind of support me, and just kind of feeling so out the loop. And I think that came with lots of disruptions in my high school education, and with the run-up of me moving into care, you know, that required a lot of social work involvement. That meant disruptions to my high school experience, and you know, that just wasn't something that I wanted to be happening, but I suppose it had to happen. And it was the people around me, the people who were making decisions for me, who felt best for me to go into care. So I think the sort of big emotions on that time were kind of feeling isolated, feeling scared, but also kind of accepting what was happening, because I knew what was going on elsewhere wasn't great. So I knew what was happening to me moving into the care system was for the best and was good for me.
Yeah, and how did that experience go?
I think it went, it's almost two-sided. So I spoke about being scared and with strangers, but at the same time, it helped me kind of think outside the box and look in on my life, like previously from outside the box. And it kind of made me realise that, you know, the sort of path that may have been set up for me being in the sort of family home will not take me where I am now. And so I think I was then able to get a good glance at what could be and the sort of support that's out there and that could help me get to where I want to be. Whereas if I was back where I came from, it wouldn't be the case. So it gave me a sort of fresh perspective on life, which I think in a roundabout way, it wasn't a great situation, but kind of catalyzed my sort of need to kind of succeed.
Just to clarify, what was your housing setup specifically?
What do you mean?
Your kind of residential setup. Were you living with a family? Were you living by yourself with a foster family?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. A couple of things. So actually, I got to experience foster care. That didn't work out that well, because with care experience people, when they move from one family into another family, you know, there's difficulties there with trying to just kind of live your life in a stranger's home. You know, there's difficulty there, like I say. I also then experienced sort of a residential home, which was just myself, and that was just kind of staff who were on rotation. And that, I think, was the turning point for me, where I kind of got to have time to myself and start that sort of reflection process that I kind of spoke about. Yeah. So yeah, experienced that foster care. And then later in my later teens, I then was fortunate to be taken in from a family member, which we consider in Scotland as kinship care. So I then lived with a family member for a couple of years as well. And,
And for a short time, I should highlight, you entered the homeless system as well.
Yes, unfortunately, yeah. When I became 17, just as I left high school at the end of my education in high school, I entered the homeless system. Mm. But although that sounds really negative and horrible, yes, it was in principle, but actually I had amazing people around me in the homeless accommodation that really supported my aspirations and dreams and just didn't discourage me, only encouraged me. Mm. And so although I was homeless, I had amazing people around me that made sure that I kind of got to where I wanted to go, regardless of the circumstances.
I'm hearing all of this and I'm thinking this has all happened between the ages of 13 and 18. This is complex enough as it is for kids who live in, I mean, I say ordinary, quote unquote, families. I can't imagine what a roller coaster it was for you during that time. Let me bring you in here, Lucy, because you also entered the system at 13 when your family could no longer care for you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I was kicked out by my biological mother. And then I went into foster care with a family I knew. So that made it easier in some ways, but more difficult in others, because I was questioning myself and thinking, where do I fit in this notion of family? Like, I'm not really part of this family, but I'm also not part of my biological family. So that was a really complex situation.
And then what happened?
So probably due to complex trauma building up, eventually I was kicked out at 16. So I had to go back to, because I didn't hear from the local authority at that point. My social workers stopped contact at 16. So I had to go back to my biological family, which was very, very difficult. Those 2 years prior to university were very, very challenging in my development. But I kind of just had it in my mindset that the only way to escape was uni. So I had that sort of tunnel vision. And I was so determined from my foster father, who had first instilled the idea in me to become a barrister, except before that I had no idea what a barrister was, I'll be completely honest. Yeah. So
I don't think many young people when they're 16, 17, 18 actually know what these terms for various professions are. So absolutely understandable.
Yeah, and I think what's a tragedy as well is in schools you don't get anyone from that. In neglected schools in particular, you don't get that anyone from that line of work. It's like a gap in your education or what you want to be, because you're expected to know what you want to be, but no one's coming to your school to talk about what a barrister is. So how are you supposed to figure that out? And there was a whole period from 16 to 18 where, you know, having zero connections in the legal profession, I was like, okay, I really need to get creative here. How am I going to find an in this industry? Because it's what I want to do. And I was fortunate enough to have found that, bizarrely, from a random lady who gave me her business card when I worked at Waitrose. So, yeah, and that was my first in. And then it was definitely difficult to build that network that I feel like my peers just sort of had already. Mm-hmm. But I was very determined to change.
Well, that's
that.
So striking that it was the drive to escape from your testing situation. I mean, that's putting it mildly, from those difficult circumstances that you were growing up with. That drive to escape is what motivated you to study, and that guidance from your foster father as well. Rebecca, what was the driving force for you?
You know, I can totally echo Lucy's statements in two things. You know, that, you know, you always kind of feel like an outcast. And two, the drive was education, because definitely for me through high school, I just couldn't get the grades with so much disruption. But it was, you know, becoming independent for a couple of years that I knew I wanted to go on to education. And even if that meant a college course, I just wanted to kind of take that first sort of baby step. And then from there, that just led on to one thing and another. And I just, the more I was in education, and I feel that education is a sort of safety blanket that helped me, because that was, you know, the next sort of 6 or 7 years of my life in the future. And it also, it transformed me to this young, naive, ignorant young girl to someone who is articulate and has 2 degrees from St. Andrews. And it's so validating. I think I've always kind of sought out that validating factor with education. So it's always been my drive. And I joke, you know, my educational journey probably isn't finished after this master's. It'll probably go on just because.
It never ends. It never ends. And it never should end, should it? I want to put this response from the Department for Education to you both. Every child deserves equal opportunity to succeed in school, regardless of their background. We will continue to support disadvantaged children, including those in care, through the pupil premium, which is risen to almost £2.9 billion in 2023 to 24, the highest cash terms rate since the funding began. Our virtual schools heads specifically champion the needs of children, with social workers helping schools understand how best to support them, while our national tutoring programme helps level the playing field for disadvantaged children. Lucy, how well do you think schools are set up to deal with children in your position?
I can only speak from personal experience, because I didn't have virtual school experience, which does sound like a really good idea, but not well at all from my experience. It's difficult because there are so many complex needs related to traumatic experience. And it just feels like, I echo what Rebecca was saying about feeling different, feeling like an outcast or feeling different. And in some way, it's really difficult to grapple with. So I do think there needs to be better funding and better understanding. And beyond that, not pitying us. I think that's the backhand of prejudice. I think there's actually, we're calling out for someone to see what's amazing about us. And there's always something amazing about every single child, particularly young people in care. Actually, we always bring a little spark in some way. And that's just waiting to be found. And the saddest part is that's not been found yet. So I think schools need to be better equipped at seeing our strengths in as much as they do our weaknesses, because at the moment it's just trauma, you know, all the darker stuff. But actually there's really like beautiful talents waiting to be discovered.
Yeah. Rebecca, I was watching an interview you did with the University of St Andrews where you talked as a collective about the stain of shame associated with growing up in care. I wonder, when you got to university, how easy it was for you to be open with your peers, potential friends, about what you experienced, or whether you chose to hide your history from those new relationships that you were building?
Yeah, I think it was more the latter. And I think that's just the context of the University of St Andrews and I suppose the prejudice that we all have about St Andrews, and it's just filled with people who are not the same as us. But actually, you know, it took me, you know, first year, you know, you kind of find your feet a little, but it wasn't until second year that I really found my feet and found my friends there. And that was when I began to be a bit more vocal about my care experience. I would say in first year, you're just kind of making sure you were surviving to the end of the week and getting through lectures. And I definitely kept that to myself. But come second year, I started doing a little bit of work with a charity in Scotland called Who Cares Scotland. And that helped me come up my shell a little bit and kind of use my care experience. Don't fall into the stigma that other people have for me, but actually shine a light on my successes, which Lucy has just kind of spoke on as well. Mm. And just kind of saying, okay, although the statistics are against me, in a general sense, actually, that's not who I am. And so I use my care experiences as a much more powerful factor of my personality, of my characteristic. And always speak about that in a very positive light. Whereas I would say probably 10 years ago, I was hiding that and kind of really fell into that stigma and that kind of stain of shame. But it never leaves you. I don't think it leaves you. I think it's always there niggling away. And depending on who you're speaking to or the sort of context you're in, it might just come up that you suddenly feel like that young 13-year-old scared self again, you know?
It never leaves you. What about you, Lucy?
Yeah, I definitely echo that. I think there's ways that you can make it your strength. And that's definitely what I did on my scholarship and pupillage applications. It actually, the first time when I applied, I was very ashamed of it and didn't speak about it at all. And I wasn't successful that year. But the second year, I was like, actually, no, I'm going to take ownership over this because I do see some strengths. And that's not to glamorize the position. Every care experienced person deserves the best therapeutic support. But there is some sort of strengths of the resilience. And that's what I was echoing in my interviews. And I think that's why I was ultimately successful. So whilst it never really left me, it also transformed me in a way.
And we talk a lot about imposter syndrome. And I wonder whether that factored in, especially in the workplace as you're going into the world of legal work.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. It can constantly make you feel like you're different, particularly in the legal industry, where people seem to have this built up network or tend to be from, you know, a private school educated background, which is certainly not me. I'm from a council estate, so it couldn't be further, you know, from that experience. And it can be isolating. I still find networking events really difficult now because I can't relate to the same conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a different culture. It's a different language. And you feel like you're not a part of it in some way. And also then, you know, being proudly care experienced, to some that can be difficult because there is that pity and that is stigma associated with it. I brought it up before and I've just like cricket silence because I don't know how to respond. And actually what I would like is like a humanistic response and being like, wow, you've come a long way, that's great, tell me a little bit more about that. Yeah. But what I get is silence.
Yeah, people don't know how to
absolutely
react to it.
And I think that really should change, because you know, if you're very proud of your background, why shouldn't you speak about it?
Absolutely. Rebecca, you are speaking about it. You've created a handbook. Tell me more about it.
I've created a handbook.
Oh, I do apologise. I thought you'd been, well, I've obviously got my facts here, but you've got plenty of words of wisdom. You should create a handbook. But what advice are you giving in the role that you are working in as the education liaison officer to children or young people who might be in your situation?
Yeah, I definitely do that with outreach programmes. I'm part of the University of St Andrews. And, you know, rather than kind of singling care experience people out that we work with, I try and make kind of general statements, and this kind of ties into what Lucy was saying. I really try and speak about care experience in very normal conversations and don't kind of allow that sort of reaction. So like my little sister's in care, and when somebody asks, my little sister lives 3 hours away from me, and when I talk about her I say, oh, you know, she lives here, and you know, and people are saying, oh, why is she there? I'm like, she's in care, she's been in there from a young age. So I try and speak about it in a very normal capacity, and I try and do that with the young people that I work with. Not to single them out, not to group all the care experience people together, because there's probably trauma in that. But I kind of talk about it as if it's normal, to try and bring that into the normal day discourse. That's what I try and do. And, you know, continue to ramp that up just so that it's in everybody's conversations and we don't get that, oh, reaction. It's the, this is normal and this happens to people, but let's work on how we can make it better.
Yeah,
people
normalising it. Thank you so much, Rebecca Munro and Lucy Barnes. Both of you should write books, by the way. Thank you both for your time.
Thank
here
you for inviting
on
me.
Woman's Hour.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Onto something very different now. How would you feel about walking down the street in your knickers? Now, this is not the start of a joke. I'm talking about a new trouserless fashion trend spearheaded by the likes of Beyoncé, the actor Emma Corrin, and the model Kendall Jenner. Seen on the catwalk at brands like Prada and Chanel, the look involves swapping a pair of trousers for a pair of statement knickers. If you've tried it or are daring and want to try it, please let us know. 84844 or at BBC Women's Hour. To tell me more about it, someone who has tried it, Julia Hobbs, Acting European Fashion Features Director at Vogue. Thank you for coming in. I was looking for the sparkly pants that I've seen you wear in the magazine. Are you in them today?
I'm not in them today. I know, but I am in my pants. I thought I was going to put a pair of trousers on today, Krupa, and I thought it's a bit disappointing if I was to come in, you know, without or, you know, in trousers. So here I am in my pants as outerwear, but they're not my sparkly knickers.
They're not your sparkly knickers.
Those were a particularly special pair.
They were gorgeous. I thought they were gorgeous.
They were gorgeous. They were very heavy. They were a pair of Miu Miu knickers designed by Mrs. Prada. They retail at a rather staggering £3,750.
My goodness. Yes. And they're not made from real gold. Let's just put that out there.
Not made from real gold. And they were very heavy. So it's sort of like wearing a sequined diaper. But as you say, I road tested them in a very warm day at the end of August. Uh-huh. And I wore them on the tube. I wore them to the Vogue offices. Did a day's work in them.
And how was that received?
By my colleagues, with sort of very little surprise, because we're kind of used to that kind of thing, I guess, happening in the office.
Yeah.
Couple of quizzical looks on the tube, but actually there is an image of it where I'm wearing said very heavy, bejeweled pants on the tube. Yeah. And the picture was actually taken by a female passenger who was sat opposite me at the time. And I said, you're going to think I'm mad. I work at Vogue and this is for a feature. You know, you could call it investigative uh-huh. journalism. Would you mind taking a picture? And she was like, of course. She didn't bat an eyelid.
Embraced it.
Yeah.
I think we need to describe the trend that we're actually talking about, because I look at them and I thought, well, they're just hot pants, aren't they? Are they?
They're a little bit more extreme than that. I think what we're seeing now is a sort of return to very elemental dressing. And we are seeing this revival of a very 1960s look, which is wearing a pair of simple black briefs over a pair of tights. It's a look that was associated, or is perhaps most famously associated, with Edie Sedgwick. She's, of course, a very tragic figure. She was a Warhol superstar, but has had a really sort of lasting mark on fashion. And she was photographed for American Vogue in 1965 as part of a youth Quaker story. And she is pictured doing an arabesque on her coffee table in a pair of black opaque tights with mm-hmm. briefs over the top and a grey T-shirt. And if you imagine in that context, it really was something very revolutionary. She was a debutante and she'd shed her clothing, quite literally. She sort of shed the trappings of that time and reinvented herself. So with Edie Sedgwick, a look that was about dance, and she herself was, she studied jazz ballet. Mm. So a look that was seen almost through the prism now of wellness culture, a look that was sporting, became something quite edgy and hedonistic in her hands.
Yeah.
So she's one of the most famous proponents of the look. But actually, if we rewind a little bit earlier to 1960, there's a wonderful Marilyn Monroe moment in the film Let's Make Love, where we see Marilyn styled almost as a beatnik, and she's wearing this wonderful oversized Aran sweater with tights and her sort of ballet knickers over the tights. And I rewatched it last night, actually, and it's one of those moments in cinema that's so charming. Mm. And it definitely feeds into what we're seeing now. You know, I think barely a week goes by where we don't get the celebrity notifications or see on Instagram celebrities wearing a jumper just with a pair of tights or a jacket and a bare leg.
And tights feel central to styling this. How do you style a big pair of knickers?
The question you never thought you'd ask today.
The question I never thought I'd ask today.
Tights are essential to it. And I think that's one of the things that's very unifying about this trend, is the tights I'm wearing today is an ever faithful pair of black M&S opaque tights. It's £8 for a pack of three. Mm-hmm. You can wear them with, you know, this sort of cinching black knickers over the top and then just a polo neck. And you probably think,
does it have to be casual on top?
Yes, the whole look is very casual. This isn't something that's in any way sort of seductive. You know, I feel, and it's something we're seeing coming very much to the fore in fashion now, is this sort of shedding and people wanting to be themselves in how they dress. And I think
really is a shedding.
Yes, it is a
quite
shedding.
Literally a shedding. I can imagine trying this out a couple of decades ago when I was at university. Absolutely, I'd be wearing a pair right now for this festive season. Now I'm not so sure. Should any age, any body shape be trying this out?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm urging you to do it, Krupa. We're going to be watching your social channels on New Year's Eve. I'm going
goodness.
To watch you to see if you're going to do it.
I need to take you shopping with me. There'll be people who might be reluctant, saying this is not for me. No matter the season, I'm not going to put a pair on.
But I think we should feel confident to embrace this. And I think it's interesting looking at the popularity of this trend in the context of Skims and the rise of shapewear. You know, Kim Kardashian's Skims label is now worth, I think it's an estimated $4 billion, and her broad size range and really showing women in these very powerful adverts, all different shapes and sizes, looking great in their shapewear. I think it does lean into this attitude of sort of take me as I am and feeling great in your own skin and owning it. And I love seeing people tag me regardless of gender, regardless of anything, tagging me when they're out and about in their underwear and seeing it. And I think it's just a sense of having fun, really. I had a colleague at Vogue Japan who's a male colleague.
And I was going to say, are men catching on to
you? Yes. He replicated the story by going out in a pair of boxers.
Right.
And I thought it was
not
great.
Quite the same, though, is it? It's just, well, maybe it is. I don't know. On that, a message here from a listener saying, didn't Superman first start that stylish look of pants over tights back in the 50s? Well, I did quite Wonder Woman earlier, didn't I?
did Superman? Well, I don't want to think so. I don't want to credit Superman for that. I think we want to put it more on Wonder Woman or Marilyn.
Yeah. Anne says, Jack D on I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue has surely been at the forefront of this fashion trend with their In My Pants section. And Patricia in Belfast says, the embarrassment of girls joining the boys at PE wearing nothing but blanket pants and an Airtex top to do national dance at secondary school was traumatic enough. Thank you for all of your messages. Thank you, Julia. If you come in next time, I want to see you in those gold, bejeweled knickers or another pair, something snazzy. But on that, fashion trends for 2024, brief me.
Oh, my goodness. great run in the knee-length pencil skirt. I think that's one of my key pieces to invest in.
Bit safer than the pants.
Bit safer. A return to real dressing. Go buy now in the sales a great grey cashmere sweater. As boring as that sounds, that's possibly the chicest item you could have in your wardrobe right now.
Thank you for your words of wisdom, Julia Hobbs there from Vogue, joining us on this new trend of big knickers, not trousers, in the place of trousers. Thank you for coming in to the Women's Hour studio. An unassisted birth or free birth is defined as giving birth without a healthcare professional in attendance. Anecdotally, more women are making this choice in the UK. But why? And what sort of experiences are they having? And is it safe and a responsible decision? Naomi Nygaard is a psychotherapist and a mother who chose free birth both her children. And Mavis Kirkham is a retired midwife and emeritus professor of midwifery at Sheffield Hallam University and co-editor of Free Birth Stories, a collection of stories from women choosing to give birth in this way. Thank you to both of you for joining us here on Woman's Hour. Mavis, I'm going to start with you in some context. Do we know how many women are choosing this option in the UK?
No, it's impossible to count an absence from statistics. And many women who choose and plan to free birth actually do not tell healthcare professionals and may book NHS home births and just say, oh, it was quick, the baby was born, or we didn't ring you up. So it is absolutely impossible to get stats on this issue.
And therefore, how did you come to be interested in this way of giving birth? And why did you decide to collect these stories?
We heard more and more stories of women who were free birthing. And we decided to collect these stories because we wanted a collection of them that was easily available. There are wonderful websites, but they're very specialist. And we wanted them to be available to women because they're inspiring stories of how wonderful undisturbed birth can be. But we also wanted them to be available to healthcare professionals because one of the motivations of free birth is previous feeling that women were really damaged by their previous experience of the healthcare system.
And that's important because we should make it clear that all of the women you spoke to had the NHS as a fallback option. Some of the women chose free birth for their second, third or fourth births and some for their first. Did you get a sense, therefore, judging by what you've just said there, that it was a better option for women who had already experienced childbirth with professional assistance?
Individuals vary vastly. Some women spoke of a long, long journey towards free birth and over a number of pregnancies or even over a lifetime. And some women, like Naomi, chose it for their first baby.
Let's bring Naomi in. So with your first pregnancy, you had planned to give birth with the assistance of NHS maternity services. But then what happened?
So the start of my pregnancy, the first 16 weeks, I was in Spain. So I wasn't able to access the usual sort of series of scans and appointments. And by the time I got back to the UK, I kind of, well, okay, what do I do now? Called my doctor. They put me in touch with the maternity services. And the maternity services were extremely stressed out by the fact that I wasn't ahead of schedule, on schedule with their protocol. And their stress really had a big impact on me. They wanted to book me in for 3 or 4 procedures at once. I found myself going from feeling like my pregnancy was going very well. I could feel that even though I felt a bit sick, I felt strong in myself. I felt that everything felt right in my body somehow. And I somehow absorbed their perception that I was a bit of an accident waiting to happen. Mm. And also a bit of a nuisance to them, you know, because they didn't know me. They didn't know all the things that their scans would have told them about me and my pregnancy. And it sort of went from bad to worse from then, really. Their perception of me stuck. It had a big impact. I really wanted to work with them and was very, I guess, looking back, I feel like I was quite naive, but I was very open to having the kind of birth that I wanted. And I persisted in wanting that until very, very, very late on. In fact, basically the day that I chose to have an unassisted birth.
And how was that received?
I decided not to call them.
Well, you said that you didn't call them. So they weren't aware that you were going to give birth this way?
No, I guess I wasn't either until it all unfolded. I'm so, so extremely lucky to have an amazing, wonderful support network. So I just want to stress that having an unassisted birth was not me on my own giving birth by myself. It was me surrounded by a couple of retired midwives I know in their 70s who obviously have 40 plus years experience, have seen many, many births. I could ask them questions. They could share pictures with me, videos of women having babies. My husband was extremely supportive. My mum, I had a doula. And I was just, and lots and lots of women, like Novia said, you know, women sharing stories about giving birth. What is it like? Asking questions about these things. That gave me a circle of support, the circle of support that I needed to give birth without a midwife.
And Mavis, that circle of support, is it crucial if women choose to give birth this way? I imagine not everyone has access to a community of retired midwives or even supportive family members all the time. Are there women choosing to do this who don't have that circle of support?
There are a few women who really choose free birth because what they want is privacy, and they really want possibly their partner there, maybe not even their partner. But most of the women in the book wanted people they trusted to support them. And they went out and they found these people. And there are good networks, there are online networks, there are doulas, and there are midwives who are willing to be incredibly supportive, although they're running a lot of risk if they're employed.
Yeah. And maybe so I should make it clear that whilst you've written this book, co-edited the book, and you describe yourself as not pro-free birth, just explain your position on this.
Yes, I support women's choice to give birth where they feel safe and with people who they feel trust them, who they trust and who are supportive. It is tragic to me that for these 50-odd women, those were not healthcare professionals as a career-long midwife, but I feel it is women's right to give birth where they feel safe, and these women did not feel safe in NHS care.
Naomi, does that resonate? Did you not feel safe in NHS care?
100%, 100%. And I resonate with Mavis that safety was 100% my main focus and the reason that I didn't call a midwife. I was really optimistic, interested in the idea of continuity of care, so getting to know a midwife or small group of midwives that would be the one that was present at my birth, getting to know them, talk with them, and feel the kind of person that they were, feel that they trusted my capacity to be able to give birth. And actually, that just wasn't on offer. I was told that it was very unlikely that I'd know the person that came. I couldn't really take that risk. I didn't know what they would be like, inviting them to my home, because I was planning a home birth. And in the end, I opted to have one of those retired midwives present at the birth, along with my mum, my doula, my husband. That was for the first birth. And then with my daughter, with my second child, it was so clear to me that I didn't want to invite that negativity that I'd experienced in antenatally with my son, that I decided not to tell the NHS about my pregnancy, and actually just my sister and my husband were present in that birth.
Were you ever fearful throughout any of this? Were you ever fearful about things going wrong? Because it's important to stress that, you know, giving birth is huge, and it can be dangerous, and it, you know, it, and there are risks for both mother and child.
That is very fortunate that I had these two retired midwives in their 70s that I could ask questions of. I knew that they had seen all manner of things, and if there was something I needed to worry about, they would tell me. And I realized that there were three sort of big risks that I needed to sort of understand and know about. And I became well versed in what I would do if those things came up for me. But really, the message I got strongly was, as a healthy woman who just had a healthy pregnancy, this was also my second child.
Yeah.
It was extremely unlikely that something, for example, like a postpartum hemorrhage would happen to me. And I knew what I would do if I did come across that. So I felt very confident.
Yeah. Maybe it's on that. You include a chapter of stories about when things go wrong with free births. Just explain what you learnt and just how prepared women are for the fact that sometimes things do go wrong.
Well, first of all, I want to say this is a very UK book, in the sense that all these women, apart from one who opted to give birth overseas, all these women had the NHS as a safety net, and on some occasions they called upon it. And this makes the book very specific to this country. But they chose to give birth where they felt safe. And one thing I learned from this book is that the women were incredibly perceptive when no one was interfering with their focus on their bodies and their birth and their babies. They were incredibly aware of what was happening. I mean, there was one woman, for instance, who had the classic obstetric emergency of a prolapsed umbilical cord, and she did all the right things. She adopted a knee chest position. She dialed 999. She was taken to hospital. She had an immediate cesarean. And she talked about her body trying to suck the baby back in this terrible emergency. And I'd never heard that said before, because although I've seen this emergency before, I'd never seen it in a woman who was so tuned in to her own body. So,
but of course, not everybody will have that instinct. And I wonder if there are some women...
They were very, very well prepared. These women read, they researched. Some had got professional qualifications before they even got pregnant. Mm. This was not a spur-of-the-moment decision.
Are there some women, in your opinion, Mavis, who should not consider this option?
I think we have to trust women's judgment. A lot of women would not dream of this option and would feel safe in hospital and wouldn't entertain this idea. And that's fine. What I'm advocating is their choice.
I want to read this response from the Royal College of Midwives. We did ask them to comment on the fact that more women are choosing free births because they've had a negative or traumatic personal experience of maternity services and feel that they have more autonomy at home. They said, whilst we recognise and respect every woman's right to develop a birth plan that's right for them, having a qualified midwife or other skilled medical professional present throughout childbirth significantly reduces the risk to both woman and child. If a woman has any concerns about their pregnancy or wishes to change their plan, we recommend that you contact your midwife or maternity team. And I also want to bring you a statement from the Department for Health and Social Care, who said that they published new guidance on providing mental and physical health checks 6 weeks post-delivery, ensuring women who decide not to give birth in the presence of a healthcare provider can more easily access medical care and advice. So again, stressing more guidance for clinicians to ensure that women who choose to have births this way are more prepared and participating. I wonder, maybe, do you think this is a sign that things are changing, that the NHS is more accepting of women wanting to give birth these ways?
I think they're accepting that this is how things are. But the problem is that we're working on the wrong model. There's no good having the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. We need to create a system where people feel safe with healthcare professionals. The problem is we've got an industrial model where women feel they're on a conveyor belt, that services are standardised. And people don't come in standard packages. If we respect the autonomy of women and we give them continuity of care, which we know greatly improves clinical outcomes, then not a lot of free births would be felt by the women to be necessary. We have the means of overcoming a lot of the problems, but we're not doing it. This is partly because the service is grossly underfunded and understaffed, but it's also because it is on the wrong model. Birth is not a mechanical thing. It's about relationships. Where people know and trust their midwives, the situation is very different.
Mavis Kirkham, Mavis Kirkham and Naomi Nigar, thank you both for your insights on this story. To the many of you who have sent in comments on this, as a retired midwife, this one on free birthing, as a retired midwife of 40 years, I've seen situations where free birthing has been an instrument of coercive control by the partner. It's always important to be alert to this happening. Thank you to the many of you who have sent in comments on this story and the others. And do join me again for tomorrow's Woman's Hour. Thanks for listening. There's plenty more from Woman's Hour over at BBC Sounds.
Hello, this is Marion Keyes.
And this is Tara Flynn.
We host a podcast you might like for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds called Now You're Asking.
Each week we take real listeners' questions about life,
love,
lingerie,
cats,
dogs,
dentists,
pockets,
or the lack of
anything really,
and apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help,
but also hopefully entertain. Join us, why don't you?
Search up Now You're Asking
on BBC Sounds.
Tankin' you.
Hi, I'm Graham Class, host of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. Join me for season 2 as we explore the future of technology evolving today. In each episode, I'll speak with the minds transforming medicine, healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Join me every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.